dear listener, for tuning in to Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
Hello, listeners. Tonight in Panopticon, episode 5, we speak with our dear friend Ben, who is an eloquent and encyclopedic resource of all things regarding United States foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. Ben has had the unique experience of having spent 6 months in Palestine as a human shield and also as a volunteer English teacher in the occupied territories. So sit back and listen in on this illuminating and important talk on U.S. foreign policy and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So basically, we're here this evening with Ben, who's a friend of mine, and... Ben, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name's Ben. I am from the States. Spent my adult life in New Mexico, particularly in northern New Mexico. Now I live in Busan, Korea. South Korea, of course, where I teach English as a second language to young children. And that's where I met your... fearless host Andy here.
Okay, so I wanted to have you on the show to talk about you have experiences, activist experiences in Palestine.
I do.
Experiences traveling there, volunteering there. Why don't you tell us a little bit how you got involved with this line of interest and activist work?
All right, with pleasure. I was always interested in, I guess, what you could loosely refer to as anti-imperialist activism, pro-liberation politics, particularly in regards to the developing world. Since I was even a boy, and certainly since I was a young teenager. So as a young man, early to mid-20s, became actively involved in progressive anti-imperialist activist movements where I was living at the time in northern and central New Mexico, particularly in Albuquerque, where I went to school, University of New Mexico. Became very involved with domestic activism in terms of the prison system, political prisoner issues, particularly regarding Mumia Abu-Jamal and other Black Panther political prisoners in the States. And that was the gist of my activism, I guess, through my early and mid-20s. But I was still very interested in international politics, like I said, particularly in reference to liberation struggles in the post-colonial developing world. And eventually became very involved in and interested in the Iraq sanctions before the Second Iraq War. Of course, as a lot of people don't know, we were doing horrible things in Iraq under the Clinton administration, vis-a-vis sanctions that didn't allow them to import medicine, food, industrial equipment, things of that nature.
Bleach,
you name it. I mean, diabetics were dying for lack of insulin in a relatively wealthy country. So,
what was the famous Madeleine Albright quote on 60 Minutes?
We believe the price is worth it. We know it's a high price, but we believe it's worth it, which is probably easy to say when you're making six figures and eating in the White House. Yeah. And
that quote was referring to the death of 500,000
right.
1 to 5-year-old Iraqis.
Right. She got straight up confronted. I think it was at Ohio State University in Columbus, actually. She got really badgered by the crowd, and that was her response, was that that it was worth it somehow.
We believe it's worth it.
Right. And certainly that, I mean, I don't know if we're getting off topic here, but that sanctions regime killed more Iraqis than these wars combined. I mean, you're looking at probably something close, if not exceeding, 1 million civilian casualties throughout the period from the end of the first Iraq War to the beginning of the second Iraq War, that they were not able to maintain their civilian infrastructures as it pertained to water, clean water, that, like we mentioned, they couldn't bring in medicine, there were food issues.
The hospitals were seriously impaired.
Right. And this was what, during the 80s, I mean, granted, Saddam was, you know, undefensible. Nobody was ever trying to say that he wasn't a horrible dictator and everything, but that was never the argument. The argument being that all of this the sanctions pain was falling on the shoulders of the, you know, the civilian population of his country, who also didn't like him.
Right.
You know, so that they were being doubly served this horrible bit of medicine, both from having to live under him and at the same time not being able to live because of him, vis-a-vis the international sanctions, which for all practical purposes can refer to as U.S. sanctions. You know,
right.
That it was us that insisted so
right.
heartily that those be done. So that was a time of great frustration, because you knew as an American and as an earnest young man, you know, to me at least, that this horrible thing was going on. But unlike the war, it wasn't even on the news, you know.
Yeah.
This wasn't something that was discussed. Most people, well-read people, people that read the papers, didn't know about this, or certainly didn't have any idea what a big deal it was. You know, and that was to me even more frustrating in a way than the lead-up to the war. You know, that there was this horrible silence surrounding what was thousands of civilian deaths a month, and it was often kids who didn't have clean water because they couldn't bring in industrial equipment to fix their, you know, hydro infrastructure and things like that. You know, and that for me was probably what made me into more of a balls out activist, as opposed to somebody that was just going to kind of be part of the peace community.
Right.
Because I felt like this was real murder going on. Nobody wanted to talk about it. So who are these people surrounding me on the streets of my city and my country if they don't even care about this? And I had a lot of fruitless attempts at trying to raise awareness about things of that nature, and people just weren't trying to hear that. You know, people didn't want to talk about it. I think this was the darkness, the almost willful darkness, that led up to 9/11 being such a surprise.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was a horrible thing what happened on 9/11, but I didn't think it was surprising.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of other more informed people about our policies in the Middle East in particular also weren't surprised. They were horrified, they were saddened. I was too. But I don't think they were surprised, you know.
Yeah.
That we were fighting a war and our public didn't know about it, so they were surprised as hell when the other side, so to speak, fought back. And that was seen as the beginning of things, as a Pearl Harbor of sorts. Well, that's not the case. I mean, we were raising hell in Iraq for those poor people. We were doing a lot of other things, you know, particularly in the Palestine issue that we're going to talk about tonight. All over the world, we had bombed the pharmaceutical plant in the Sudan, you know, and a lot of this was going on under the Clinton administration, you know, and that our great accomplishment in the Middle East was his relatively dishonest and disingenuous attempts at brokering a peace deal between Israel and Palestine that was seen as, you know, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. That's what, you know, like mainline prick newscasters and commentators on the Sunday morning news show say about Palestine. They had all these great offers through the Clinton administration from Israel, and they just wouldn't take them. They were overreaching. None of that was true. There was so much misinformation, you know,
yeah.
around that and around the sanctions in Iraq and around the general, you know, general colonial nature of our foreign policy through all those years, and certainly way before that, you know.
Yeah.
But that's when I was a young man coming into this, and that's what I know about, you know. Anyway, that's a long answer, but anyway, I was very involved in my local Albuquerque anti-war movement, you know, leading up to 9/11, when there wasn't much of one, in the time after 9/11, when we first tried to present, I guess, alternatives to an armed invasion of Afghanistan, which we knew was fruitless. That was more a matter of dignity than of real tactics. Nobody thought that we weren't going to go into Afghanistan.
Right.
But after that, more horribly, more horrifyingly, the drumbeat into the Iraq war. And those of us that were reading the books that really cared knew that even before 9/11, that was something that certainly the Bush administration was gunning for.
Yeah, and all 2002 was a
right.
fucked up time.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, those were dark several years of my life and the lives of a lot of other people, most particularly the people that live in those countries, but to a lesser degree, emotionally at least, also for us that really cared about that back home, you know, and that you could just, it was like watching this, as they say, watching a car crash in slow motion, but you can't do anything about it.
Right.
And I had learned a good bit about Iraq via my interest in the sanctions, and I had some pretty good predictions, as did a lot of other people, not trying to toot my own horn, but let's say somebody who was paying attention could get a pretty good hand on the pulse of the fact that things weren't going to go well after the initial war, which was going to be a breeze, and that the Sunnis and the Shiites weren't going to be homies, you know, that the Kurds didn't want anything to do with either of the others, that the administration didn't have a working knowledge of the socio-political norms of that area, you know, and indeed Bush didn't know there was such a thing as Sunni and Shia Islam. He didn't. That's incredible, you know, even today, that he didn't know that.
It's way worse than not even being aware of there being Catholics and Protestants within Christianity.
Right, right. I mean, the idea that he, after having made the decision to invade Iraq, didn't know that there were these two major and often not very simpatico branches of Islam. And this goes back way back. This goes back essentially to the, you know, within a century of the beginning of Islam.
It was the split. Ali, I think, was Muhammad's
son-in-law or something. Yeah, I mean, but that they were disastrously unprepared for what was going to happen, that they almost didn't seem to care, didn't want to think about it, and the books, the Woodward books and everything that have come out since, and The End of Iraq by Peter Galbraith, and Inside the Emerald City, by a fellow, I think, from the Baltimore Sun. He's got an Indian name, I can't remember it right now. These books that these people got really good access after the war and proved a lot of what we thought then, that these guys didn't have a working knowledge of that area. They didn't, I don't know, you feel like you could have taken a bunch of the guys I was building houses with at the time and they would have done a better job. You know, that it was almost willful
ignorance
and incompetence. I mean, just the staggering level of incompetence makes you wonder if they wanted it to fail.
Well, in the
how could they have messed up that bad, you know?
The time span of the U.S.-Iraqi relationship between, like, 1982 at the start of the Iran-Iraq War up to Desert Storm was, like, never spoken of. That crucial 10 years when we supported Iraq and gave them Saddam.
Right.
I mean, like, in 1986, Ronald Reagan, I believe, sent Saddam Hussein a pair of golden spurs for Christmas.
VO1 Donald Rumsfeld. He delivered them, I believe. That's a picture of them shaking hands.
Yeah, that was in 83.
Rumsfeld was somewhere in the Pentagon at that time.
He was a special emissary to Iraq.
Was that right? Yeah. Yep. So, you know, it was a time after 9-11. Well, before 9-11 was so sad that you couldn't get otherwise nice people to care about the horrible things that was taking place in their names.
Yeah.
After 9-11, it was, as you know, scary, and you didn't quite know what you were dealing with, because otherwise normal people had become almost like, you know, and I hate to say this, because I know so many awesome people in the States, but a lot of people became scared into a corner in which they let themselves begin to behave like Germans might have in the 30s, you know, in which there was going to be an enemy, and goddammit, we were going to beat their asses, you know, and there was not going to be any two ways about that, and they didn't really want to hear the details, they just wanted to go for it.
Right.
I mean, the fact that Bush's flimsy-ass arguments for invading Iraq were even allowed to kind of hold any weight on the news and stuff speaks to a really dangerous level of bending over on behalf of the mainstream media. I mean, that was shameful stuff. If I, as like a 23, 24-year-old construction worker, knew and could accurately point out what was bullshit about everything they were saying every day, why couldn't Dan Rather?
Right.
Why couldn't those guys who have been doing this since my mom and dad were not even met?
Yeah.
You know, it was a real disgrace. Nobody wanted to speak out. Nobody wanted to be seen as unpatriotic. And what did it get us? You know, that war, in many senses, destroyed our country.
And,
you know,
still,
and certainly
still
destroyed
news.
Iraq. And it still is, yeah.
It's still news.
And maybe more importantly, as a bigger deal anyway, on a human level, look what it's done to the people there.
Yeah, it's
horrible. It's unbelievable. And there was very little intelligent debate about that in the mainstream media.
Yeah.
Even like the New York Times. All those people were being total pawns. You know, I think even the New York Times, like it's, you know, some amazing newspaper, but it is one that is not seen as a Republican newspaper.
It's the lightning rod of intellectual news in the States.
Right. And, you know, nobody wanted to touch it. Nobody wanted to talk about it because they were afraid of the unpatriotic.
Well, there was never the basic question of, is this a good idea and is it necessary or not? It was just like, if we're going to do it, how should we do it?
Right. A matter of tactics rather than
just presupposing that this should happen.
Right. You're right. There was that to it. There was that to it. And there was the a real lack of vigor in the examination of his false-ass claims. And all of them was false. And they knew that it was false. You know, certainly Bush and those guys, they've made their story now that the whole mistake was based on George Tenet, the then head of the CIA, as being, it was a slam dunk. you know, as if you could blame the whole thing on that. They made up their minds, they wanted to go, they found a reason, they trumped it up, they pressured the hell out of intelligence analysts, otherwise honest intelligence analysts in the CIA and the Pentagon, some of whom quit rather than stand behind that.
Right.
And they got the story they wanted by strong-arming the hell out of these poor people worried about their pensions. And that story was total bullshit. It was obvious then. It's a fact now.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, it was a secretive, scary administration. And they knew they wanted that war before 9/11, and certainly that was the floodgate for them.
Yeah, probably the climax of all that misinformation was Colin Powell's address to the UN about the Niger yellow cake,
right,
which turned out to be like a
total hogwash. Yeah. Which he didn't want to do. He didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And Dick Cheney told him, oh, you can take a hit. You've got the points, as in the popularity points in the public opinion polls, you know. Right. He didn't want to do that. Powell was the only one. Powell and his buddy Armitage, you know, who were the only two of those people that I would even shake the hands of if I ever met him. And even that's probably a stretch, but they were the only ones trying to offer any kind of opposition. But at the end of the day, once the decision was made, they were loyal soldiers, and they went ahead and pulled their weight, just like Powell in front of the UN there, yeah.
Right.
But they knew. They knew that it was hogwash, and they knew that it was going to be a train wreck once the initial war went quickly, which obviously was going to, and it did. After that, then what? What have you got? Bush had no idea what he was dealing with. I mean, this guy, not intellectually curious, not very interested in his briefs from the CIA, not asking questions, scaring the people around him, you know, not his appointees, but the military, the permanent people around him, you know, like Joint Chiefs of Staff, people of that nature were horrified by his lack of intellectual curiosity,
right,
and just kind of bullheadedness, like, this is what we're doing, this is what we're doing, it's going to be fine, I prayed on it.
Yeah. I heard some interesting kind of comparison to this journal to the Iraq War vis-a-vis journal to the Vietnam War, whereas in the Vietnam War, you had a lot of the top military brass were gunning for the war, and the
right.
civilian brass in the White House surrounding LBJ
right.
were the more kind of hesitant ones. Whereas
right.
with this situation, you had the civilians
right. pushing for it.
People who'd never been in war,
right.
never heard a bullet was by their
that's right.
gunning
that's for sure.
gunning for it. And the military was like, I don't know if this is
right. I don't know if this is a great idea, and I don't know if it's a great idea with 150,000 guys when I asked for 400,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not that that's the point. I mean, like I said, to me, it's a matter of morality, not of tactics. But either way, like you said, the military didn't want to do it. Obviously, they're going to do it. You know, that's their warrior culture and stuff. They're going to end up following orders in the end. And that's true all over the world. You can't blame that on America. You know, the guilt, the ownership of guilt resides firmly in the place of that civilian administration. You know, Wolfowitz and Richard Perle.
Right.
And those people. I mean, these people, if they were from a different era or a different country, would be, like, in the Hague, you know, on trial,
yeah.
like Milosevic was.
Right.
Because look what they've done to those poor people over there.
Right.
With no end in sight. It might not get better for them ever.
Yeah.
Or anytime soon. You get millions of refugees spread out all over the neighboring countries. People that used to have jobs and houses, you know.
Well, I remember back in 2003 when it was getting started. It was, like, March 2003. And I was thinking at the time, I had a more cynical idea about it probably than the mainstream media and the people around me did, but I thought, this is going to be a fucking shit show. It's going to be horrible, but I'll give them 3 years at best, and then we'll get out of there. And
yeah.
now it's 2010.
It's 2010,
been
yeah.
7 years.
It's yeah.
just as bad as it ever was.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Well, look what was happening. Your three-year prediction, what was happening there 3 years after? You know, that was probably the height of the horror
yeah.
over there in a lot of ways. That was when they had to admit that they were starting over in terms of their attempts to train a police and military force.
Right.
3 years in, you're starting over?
Right.
What the hell have you been doing for the last 1,100 days?
Right, it was like 08 was the surge, and that was one of the big milestone moments in the
right.
military
right. Right.
Strategy.
Right.
I guess it somehow worked according to
you. Well, I think it worked in the sense that it was on a very quiet public relations basis, very quietly coupled with buying off local tribal chiefs.
Yeah, and
just being like, yo, we'll pay you guys like $1 million a month to stop fighting, or whatever. I made that figure up. But,
right.
you know, buying off these tribal warlords, who were the exact reason we wanted to win it, was to build a democracy.
Right.
And now you're so desperate that you got to just buy these guys to be mini-dictators, mini-Saddams all over the country.
Well, and dumping a whole bunch of troops in with the surge strategy is kind of the same thing as saying, I got this person to be quiet by smothering them.
Right.
where I would have was otherwise just telling them to be quiet.
Right.
You know,
so indeed.
It's
indeed.
Like, it's,
anyway.
God, I feel like we could do a whole show just about that.
Yeah, no doubt. That's but another issue of great passion to me.
What I'm really interested in is the experiences you had, in you as an American, uh-huh. you know, in Palestine. So I guess if we could kind of segue into that.
Let's do it.
So, like, you get involved in the States.
Right. Right.
Let's start.
Okay, well, I was highly involved. I was living and breathing for those issues at the time in the lead-up. Like I said, to the war, after the war, and tied into that to me was a slow coming but steady education, or re-education as it were, about the real nuts and bolts and the stark realities of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. And that I had been raised in a small Midwestern town in a Christian family, not a closed-minded one by any means, a relatively progressive one, but still, living and growing up, reading Newsweek, and things like that. Even as a kid, I was a news hound.
Right.
There is a strong pro-Israeli bias that we kind of carry with us without ever thinking twice about it.
Take for granted. Right.
You take it for granted. You just don't really think about it, you know. So I carried with
pro-Israeli
me...
Pro-Israeli bias.
Right. I carried with me kind of almost like a latent, something I wasn't aware of, pro-Israeli bias. I would say most Americans do, you know. I mean, I know that they do. And that...
Well, that's the Judeo-Christian culture we live in.
Right, well, there is a historical and religious bond there, and there's the... Obviously, our knowledge of the Holocaust that deservingly provides a sense of empathy towards the people that lived through that and their descendants, which I believe in. I agree with that.
Yeah.
But as time went by and I began to learn, and I would credit Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! With a lot of this to me, as those years went by, it became harder... and harder for me to kind of avoid. I kind of, as an activist, almost avoided the Israeli-Palestinian thing because I didn't really understand it. It seemed so overwhelming. The history went so far back. It just seemed so complicated. And I just kind of avoided it. That lessened with time throughout my mid-20s and around the beginning of the war and everything. And I began to really investigate it and became furious about it and became, you know, I would like to think pretty well informed on it over the course of a few years. And became politically active around those issues as well, like Men and Women in Black was active in Albuquerque. There was not a sizable, but a very interesting and relatively vocal Arab and particularly Palestinian population in the student neighborhood where I lived in Albuquerque. And I just became more interested in that, became more aware of it, and I think once you tear through the veneer of your American childhood, it becomes starkly clear that it's a situation of colonial, not only occupation, but land theft and of sheer physical brutality. I read a lot about the First Intifada and their nonviolent tactics being met with really strong violence by the Israeli Defense Forces, which horrified me. You know, I've always been a nonviolent activist. You know, I've never thrown a punch at a demo or even close. Very interested in the teachings of Gandhi and everything. So when I read about the way that the First Intifada, you know, which was way before my time, this is like mid and late 80s, but the way that was met with repression and the way that the settlements, which had become a big issue by then, you know, were just such an obvious land grab. And for me, it harkened back to my disgust with the handling of the Native American issues in my own country's history.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a very clear parallel to me, and I think to a lot of other people, that, boy, learn a lesson from that, because that was one of the greatest sins in the history of humanity.
Yeah.
The way that Native American people were treated by Europeans, including my forefathers, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
You know, my folks, not my parents, but my people going further back were probably part of that.
Yeah.
And that is something that had affected me since childhood. And to see it again happening over there, and knowing that it was our tax dollars paying for it, and the total lack of voice that the Palestinian cause was given in the mainstream media, or really even in other forms of media. I mean, that's still one of those issues that a lot of otherwise progressive people don't really want to talk about, because they don't want to be called anti-Semitic, or because they find the history so complex that they don't feel qualified to really form a good opinion.
Well, the fact that you bring up the anti-Semitic label, can we talk about how that kind of hinders any kind of, you know, because it's people don't have a clear distinction about what's Jewish, what's Zionist, what's Israeli.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I feel like a lot of people who are anti-Israeli policies get branded anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mainstream news, there's a lot of ignorance about what these terms mean.
Right.
Being anti-Semitic, first of all, Arabs are Semitic.
Right. Something first of all, you never hear,
brought up, right? But, yeah, that definitely kind of hinders a lot of that criticism, right?
That is the single biggest thing holding it back. Any sort of real wave of mass acknowledgement or mass empathy for the untenable situation the Palestinians have been in all these years, you know, through no fault of their own, really, having not lifted a finger during the Holocaust, and obviously having been pretty far away from it, and
right.
Probably largely unaware of it, to be honest, being a rural population. I would say, you know, this is something that I've dealt with a lot in my own activist life, and even now, I don't know if I consider myself an activist at this point in my life, but I still am very vocal in my social life and in general about Palestinian issues. And part of doing that, especially in a North American context, is to be called, or at least suspected of being, anti-Semitic, which is to say having a general dislike of Jewish people, I guess, is how it's used. I mean, it's rather misused because, like you said, Palestinians are Semitic too.
Right.
But, you know, certainly that's what it's come to mean, and we all know that.
Well, Arabic is a Semitic language.
Indeed, indeed. That's something that has really bothered me and hurt me over the years. Like, at demonstrations back home, going out of your way to address those concerns and to show that that's not the basis of your activism, the basis of your concern. And still to be called a Nazi or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no group of people in history that I would less want to be associated with than the Nazi Party. You know,
that goes
without saying for any human rights activist. I mean, give me a break.
Right.
That's not the sort of motivation that gets you into looking out for other people around the world. They're trying to.
Right, right.
Well,
so you get involved with this movement back home in Albuquerque, I presume?
Yeah.
And then what led you into the development of actually going there?
All right.
What's that process like?
Let's come back to the anti-Semitic thing later, once we cover some more ground.
Well, if you want to cover it now, it's cool. I mean, it doesn't matter.
All right. Well, yeah, I do have a few more thoughts on that.
Say sorry. Absolutely anything you want to say.
My thoughts on that are that it's unfair, that it's illogical, that it's 99% of the time not true, that it is used in a very cowardly manner, at best in an ignorant manner, and I think just as often in a cowardly manner, a tactical manner, with which to deface really, really obvious and legitimate global and human rights concerns about the Palestinian situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we have to remember, after all, that the Israeli government, I wouldn't really call it a democracy, because the occupied people there aren't allowed to vote, but within its own population, is a democratically elected government. And that because they come from a certain religious faith, and the after effects of the Holocaust, which nobody's trying to diminish or look over, but still, because of that, you can't criticize this democratically elected government.
Right.
When Ariel Sharon was in office, the butcher of Sabra and Shatila, this horrible man, this war criminal, this openly racist, horrible man, I couldn't criticize him without being called a Nazi. Well, who's the one building barbed wire fences around civilian populations and telling them they can't leave? Who's the one locking up everybody who tries to even peacefully raise their voice or objections to his horrible policies and putting them in prison for indefinite terms? And can't even call mom once a month. Who's the one openly stealing land from a neighboring civilian population that isn't even close to being able to defend itself militarily? That's Nazi shit.
Yeah.
That was the government of Israel. That wasn't me. You know. And that wasn't Norman Finkelstein. And that wasn't Mumia. And that wasn't all the other people around the world who were trying to talk about this at the time. We were the peaceful people.
Yeah.
You know. My thoughts now are that people should read the works of Norman Finkelstein, a professor He has a great book called The Holocaust Industry. His father survived Auschwitz. His mother survived Majdanek, both of which concentration camps, for anybody that doesn't know, during the Holocaust. He's a very controversial professor in the States, but a very straight shooter. And
where is he a professor at?
Well, I think he got fired from Columbia behind that book due to pressure, social pressure towards universities. It's called The Holocaust Industry by Norman Finkelstein. And I'm not a real expert on his life, but I believe that he was fired from his job at Columbia for that, and I don't know where he's at now. I know he's still active. He was just on Democracy Now! Recently. He raises, in a very brave way, I mean, this is an American Jewish man, very stark realities about what's going on there, and disavows the idea that the Holocaust is an excuse to turn around and do something similar, if not quite as all-out bloodthirsty, but something, you know, in the neighborhood of similar to the Palestinian people, as was unfortunately visited upon Jewish people during the war.
Right.
You know, and he's a fascinating guy. He encapsulates a lot of my ideas better than I can. I would highly recommend his works to anybody. It is a very useful shield that the pro-Israeli lobby in the States, groups like AIPAC,
ADL,
and the Israeli government itself, have been able to use, both with which to deflect righteous criticism of its policies, and with which, you know, maybe more sadly, to brainwash a lot of its own youth. Like, a lot of Israeli kids are raised to believe that the world hates them. And that's sad, because I don't think that's the case. I don't doubt, I know, I mean, having been there, there's a lot of beef and a lot of bad blood between Israel and surrounding Arab countries. That's true. But is it based on religion? No. And should an Israeli kid be afraid to go say hi to a bunch of American and Canadian and European kids when he's backpacking in India? That is ridiculous. But they've been conditioned to believe that the whole world hates them because that's part of their foreign policy mechanism, is to always, you know, be under siege, and the civilian population needs to believe that. And that's unfortunate, because I know from experience there's a lot of really cool young people in Israel, and unfortunately they've been led to believe that it's them against the world, and maybe America will help them a little bit, but it's them against the world, everybody hates them. And most people in the world, you know, particularly here we are in Asia, don't know or care about Israel-Palestine, you know what I mean? They've been...
It's not a concern.
You know, it's not a concern, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, I guess that, you know, kind of encapsulates my thoughts on the anti-Semitism thing. I don't worry about it too much anymore, but I know even now, even here in Busan, I have personal relations that are affected by that, with Jewish North American friends that have started to act differently towards me once they saw maybe one too many Facebook rants or articles that I've posted, and that they, even as non-Israelis, have been, you know, raised or come to believe that I must not like them as Jewish people if I'm this vocal about the Palestinian liberation struggle, you know. And that hurts me on a daily basis, even here in South Korea, where, you know, Koreans could know or care less about, for the most part, about those issues, but they have their own situations going on.
Yeah, simply because of geopolitical necessity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the way I was raised to think about it. I remember people I was growing up around saying things like, well, these people have hated each other for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And then I started to look into the actual situation and research a bit and realize, like, it has fucking nothing to do with Judaism and Islam.
Right.
I mean, if anything, Islam consider themselves to be people of the book with Christians and Jews.
Right.
The analogs between Judaism and Islam and Christianity and Islam, all the three of them together, are very bound and historically bound and close.
Absolutely.
And friendly, you know, as far as Orthodox Islam is concerned.
Right.
So it's not about the religion.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And I feel like people try to say it's about that to dissuade any kind of rational argument about the actual political situation on the ground.
That's bullshit. A good point. That's a really good point. And I can't tell you, I grew up, you know, working blue-collar jobs, and even after my activist career began, was still working blue-collar jobs, and people would always say that, man, what the hell would you possibly go over there and get in the middle of that for? Those people have been doing that for thousands of years, nothing's ever going to fix it. Are you crazy? Right. And that wasn't true. There was no such thing as Israel, I mean, you know, since biblical times, until 1948.
Right.
You know, after World War II.
Right.
You know, it's not this ancient history.
No, it's not at all.
It's, yeah, the idea that it's some sort of ancient struggle that will never be fixed. I mean, it might be true that it never gets fixed, but it's not an ancient struggle. It's a modern.
And it's not in anyone's DNA. It's not.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's not endowed within the confines of the people.
Absolutely not. And some things we can agree and disagree about in terms of this discussion. I don't mean me and you, but like us and pro-occupation people or Israeli settlers, hardliners.
Right.
We can have different opinions on the same thing. That is simply historically untrue. That is not up for debate. The idea that this goes back thousands of years is just ridiculous. That's simply not part of history.
Right. I mean, because it basically goes back, to the Balfour Declaration, is that right?
The Balfour Declaration was a crucial component in the whole thing.
That's when basically this started. And that was like a note by
a British
ministerial British person.
Right. A British government person who said that Britain should, after all, strive to create a Jewish state within Mandate Palestine, which is to say the part of Palestine that Britain inherited upon the fall of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I.
Right.
You know, which is now, I think, most of Jordan, all of what is now Israel, I believe, and
I think
certainly all of what is all part of the occupied territories now.
Yeah, I think the French got Syria and maybe Lebanon.
Right, those were French colonies, indeed.
Well, so, you're getting involved in this in Albuquerque. This is in the mid-90s?
No, this is in the early 2000s.
Okay. Then you...
I was very wrapped up in it all. I became vaguely aware of a group called the International Solidarity Movement, which was a Palestinian-led international human rights group that was bringing foreigners, Westerners usually, but not always, into the occupied territories to document human rights abuses that were a part of daily life there, of which people would be surprised to the degree to which those exist. I mean, everybody knows it sucks for the Palestinians, but I think a lot of people will be surprised how brutal it is. We'll get into that later.
Yeah.
And also to act as human shields in face of the just brutal live fire sort of treatment that that Palestinians were receiving from the Israeli Defense Forces within the occupied territories. That it made sense to put white folks, to be blunt, people who are recognizably Western and not Palestinian, in the line of fire. And that wasn't something that everybody wanted to do, obviously, but this organization was created by a couple Palestinian activists and intellectuals and some Israelis, I should add, pro-freedom Israelis, who would make this opportunity available for anybody who around the world was willing to go there and, put their neck on the line or see firsthand what was going on. And that was the birth of the International Solidarity Movement at the beginning of the Second Intifada. And
when is that, just for our listeners who don't know, and me included?
The beginning of the Second Intifada started, I mean, there was a lot of pressure building up because the peace agreements failed.
So we have two intifadas.
Yeah. Separated by
when is the first?
The first is kind of like late mid 80s, almost up through the beginning of the peace processes, failed, unfortunately, peace processes in the early 90s.
Okay. And then the second
that
intifada
resulted in a great deal of imprisonment, but I think not nearly the bloodshed that the second one did. It was largely an unarmed movement from the Palestinian side, unlike the second one. It resulted in mass incarceration and, a good bit of a bloodletting, unfortunately, but I don't think quite as much as the second one. Again, I'm no historian.
And when is the Second Intifada?
Second Intifada kicked off in fall of 2001 when Ariel Sharon, surrounded by hundreds of bodyguards and special services guys and everything, as a provocation with which to win an election, marched from the Wailing Wall, which is Jewish territory, and this is all Old City of Jerusalem stuff. You know how you got the Wailing Wall and, the Dome of the Rock, the Islamic holy site is right there on top of it, quite literally. I mean, you can look at them both at the same time. So that's a tense area. You know, both sides feel like they have the right to it. Both sides have pretty legitimate arguments to why they should have access. And
right.
Blah, blah, blah. He made a grand statement that he knew was going to be very, very provocative towards an already kind of bubbling over Palestinian anger by marching up the walkway out of the Jewish area of the Wailing Wall onto, like, the Dome of the Rock. Not literally on the Dome of the Rock, but that complex.
Yeah.
And he knew what he was doing, and he was trying to create a violent uprising amongst Palestinians that would make Israelis scared enough to vote his warmongering ass into office to keep him safe. And that very day, they started throwing rocks at his entourage. They were pissed. I mean, this is an issue of great sacrilege to them.
Okay.
To have Ariel Sharon, of all people, it should be explained, was the most offensive Israeli to the Palestinian people and, you know, and to me and a lot of other people around the world, certainly Arabs around the world, and particularly the Palestinians. He had overseen a lot of brutal things. He had been, in many ways, the father of the settlement movement, which is probably the biggest problem now. He had, most importantly, in terms of the visceral hatred towards him from the Palestinian people, overseen the massacre at Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon during the Lebanon War, in which, you know, hundreds, if not, I think maybe over 1,000, just straight up civilians, like moms and dads and kids, packed inside this refugee camp in Lebanon, were killed by a phalangist militia, which is a religious sect in Lebanon, who were friendly to the, you know, friendly to the Israeli army at the time.
So what is the
so
term?
He oversaw that and was known throughout, I'm sorry to interrupt, it's just
no.
Point.
Yeah, yeah.
Known as, you know, the butcher of Sabra and Shatila, a bloodthirsty, Hitler-like figure in that conflict.
Right.
The most offensive person, absolutely. Not only in that conflict, but in the history of that conflict from the Arab side, you know. So he knew what he was doing marching up there with all his hundreds of security guards. And, of course, the boys started throwing rocks, and there began the second Intifada, the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Al-Aqsa is the name of the mosque there, the Dome of the Rock, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. These are the second most holy places in Islam after, you know, obviously the Mecca and Medina there in Saudi Arabia.
Right. What does the term Intifada mean?
Intifada is an Arabic term. It literally means, like, to cast off, to shake off. If you can picture, like, you know, a monkey or something jumping on your back and you don't want it there and you're just squiggling like hell to try to cast it off, you know?
Right,
you know,
okay.
That's what it means, to cast something off.
Gotcha, gotcha.
And so the second Intifada had a much different character than the first. It was, in many parts, an armed anti-colonial struggle against the Israeli occupational forces. I mean, bearing in mind, I mean, this was 44 years into the illegal occupation of the occupied territories. You know, that all began in the 1967 war. People were fed up. You know, you're looking at your second and almost third generation of young men growing up like that. They were ready to go. You know, the peace agreements had failed. So it was characterized as characterized by more armed resistance. Still very one-sided from a military standpoint. I mean, obviously Israel's got a strong air force. I mean, for God's sake, they've got nuclear weapons. I mean,
heavily supported by the U.S.
Ah, sure, sure. I mean, they wouldn't have anything approaching that kind of an arsenal without the U.S. Not even close.
Right.
Not even close. But regardless, they have it. So even if the Palestinians now are all of a sudden got some guns and are shooting back here and there, it was still a very one-sided thing from a military standpoint. You know, and that was coupled with, you know, you'll recall, like, the surge in suicide bombings, people sneaking into, you know, Palestinians from the occupied territory sneaking into Israel and blowing themselves up, like, in a Sbarro's, or there was one horrible event in a Passover meal in a hotel dining room. You know, a lot of really tasteless acts of suicide bombing, you know, in which a lot of Israeli civilians were killed. You can't forget that, and you can't look away from that, you know.
Despicable but understandable acts.
Well, certainly to me, armed resistance was understandable. I'm not a huge fan of the suicide bombings, but I think that people shouldn't judge it too hard without placing a great deal of energy into trying to, at least through the powers of empathy, trying to imagine what it's like to grow up in the occupied territories. You know, I mean, it's not done in a religious manner. I can tell you that from my experiences there. It's not something they do to go get their 72 virgins, as the American media loves to say. It's always about that. That might be true for Al-Qaeda people in Britain, but Palestinians are not Al-Qaeda types at all. You know,
it's a much more...
So for them, it was a tactical thing. It was like, you've ruined my life. You've ruined my father's life. You've ruined my grandfather's life. I see no hope. I see only a desire to, in the name of my people, in the name of my country, in the name of my family, who you might have wiped out or locked up three generations now, I see the need simply for animal revenge, or even a tactical revenge.
Yeah.
You know, that I'll scare you out of my land. Obviously that didn't work. The Israeli military had crushing military power that they brought to bear. Operation Protective Shield, I think it was called, was after Sharon got elected behind his hijinks, you know, there at the Wailing Wall, got elected because people were scared of this Intifada and they wanted a strong arm, and he was a strong arm. He wasn't afraid to, you know, to open the gates of hell and have a war. That was pretty much all he knew. So they brutally reoccupied all the cities in the West Bank one by one. Operation Defensive Shield is what it's called.
Okay.
So they went city by city from Ramallah up to, you know, Qalqilia, Nablus, and they finally got to Jenin, city in the northern West Bank, famous for its resistance to the occupation over the years. And there, in Jenin refugee camp, they met a pretty well-organized and pretty effective, temporarily effective, you know, unofficial military structure, you know, like in the form of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Kitab Al-Aqsa, as they refer to in English as the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is, you know, kind of associated with Fatah, one of the ruling, or the main, you know, ruling group of Palestinian politics over the years. Arafat's group, you know, is the easiest way to associate it.
Right.
And they had their shit together. They were organized. They had booby traps all over the place. They had guns. They were ready to throw down, and they did. And it turned into a pretty big battle that lasted several days. And the Israeli response to that, after, you know, I think after losing a dozen and a half soldiers, was to just kind of level it with air power. And they did so, and that resulted. I mean, luckily a lot of the people had gotten away by then and left the camp. But it resulted still in, you know, several dozen civilian casualties amongst the Palestinian population, who are already a bunch of pissed off refugees. Like, they're living in refugee camps since 1948.
Yeah.
You know, these aren't people that are like shrinking violets by any means. I mean, people were fighting back, you know.
When is this again? This is 2000.
This gets into March of 2002.
Okay.
So this is the last crux move of Operation Defensive Shield. Because it's the furthest north, and because they knew it was going to be the toughest. Because Jenin had a reputation.
Okay.
You know. And so they, you know, they went in there with their space-age weaponry that we give them, and they just blew up this, you know, you can imagine maybe how densely crowded these refugee camps are. Shoddy construction, and it's just people living on top of other people. It's crowded as hell. And they blew up, like, the whole center of it. With helicopters and I think airplanes as well.
Jeez.
And that became the definitive moment of the Second Intifada, you know, and the outrage, I'm sorry, around the world, from the Arab world, from all over the world, people were saying, this is off the hook. You guys are just slaughtering people over there, you know. Because there was not, A, legal reason for them to invade Jenin camp, and B, there was not any way that, however impressive their first day or two was, that these groups like Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade were going to be able to sustain this. You know, they didn't have tons of ammunition, you know, like everything they had was smuggled in one by one, you know. And they didn't have, you know, water to drink, much less like Apaches, you know.
Yeah.
So it became seen as just another act of just brutal force on the part of the Israelis when a little discretion might have been better served, you know. Might have served better, I should say. So that during that, and this was the height of outrage towards Israel, maybe, you know, in my lifetime, certainly since I started following it, was in the midst of this several days long Jenin camp massacre, Jenin camp uprising, whatever you want to call it. During this time, the whole world's pissed except for the American government. And Bush goes on TV and calls Ariel Sharon a man of peace as he's slaughtering these kids and his mothers in their shitty refugee houses in Jenin camp. And they shouldn't have been there in the first place because they should have been given a place to live 60 years ago. And that was, just really offensive. You know, I don't know how else to put it. It was offensive, it was degrading, it was racist, it was colonialist, it was a dismissal of all the rights of these brown people in their shitty cement block houses. You know, because our white friend Ariel Sharon is a man of peace. Yeah, well, he wasn't. And that was a major breaking point in terms of the international empathy America received after 9/11. You know, as much as the invasion of Iraq was Bush's support of Sharon's policies, particularly there in Jenin in March, April 2002, was just like, you know what? I felt bad for y'all after 9/11, but as long as you keep electing people like this, you can kiss my ass, because this man is a murderer and you're calling him a man of peace. And, you know, I went to Jenin not too long after that invasion, and it's not propaganda or something that too much force was used. I mean, this crowded little, it's like a little city, a refugee camp, you know, there's like 13,000 people living there. Like a huge center swath of it was leveled. There were people in those houses. You know, nobody really knows how many people died, but it's certainly several dozen. And a lot more left homeless and destitute, and, you know, ambulances were blown up when trying to go in there and get the wounded. It would be hard to overestimate the brutality that was shown from the Israeli Defense Forces in that operation, I can tell you that. Pretty brutal. And a lot of scarred people wandering around there today. Little kids living through that, huddled in their houses, hoping they're not the next one to get blown up. You know, pretty real thing.
Well, this puts us in a perfect place to kind of break for part two.
All right.
of the talk, and that's where we're going to get into your personal experiences in Palestine. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to break, and then we'll pick right back up.
Let's do it.
And that is the end of part one of the interview. In part two, Ben will tell us of his experiences in Palestine. I hope you enjoyed the show.